Well, you might ask, why did the organising committee choose this particular topic with regard to the New Age, science, truth and the New Age? Aren't there many other more interesting and perhaps seemingly more relevant things we might think about? Alternative therapies, business management courses, the human potential movement. I hope they weren't guided simply by my own particular background and interest, which has led me to research this area, particularly over the last 2 years or so. My own interest in the area arose not simply because I spent 7 years as a research chemist, but because of reading Leslie Newbegin's very influential and I think important book, Foolishness to the Greeks. In that book, he speaks of the need for a missionary encounter with Western culture. He himself, as many of you all know, was a great missionary statesman in India, working in India for much of his life, now continuing to work in Birmingham. But as he came back to Britain after many years in Asia, it struck him that Christian missiologists and theologians had done a lot of work in seeking to contextualize, is the in word, the gospel in other cultures, but perhaps we had neglected over the last 50 years to think afresh about contextualizing the gospel in Western culture. And we needed a new effort there. And in speaking about this, he says in that book I mentioned, I'm concerned to ask this central question. What would be involved in a genuinely missionary encounter between the gospel and our post-Enlightenment culture? I think, he says, that encounter at the intellectual level will mean an encounter with what forms the mental and spiritual heart of our culture, modern science. And in doing this, we must pursue the question, what can be known and how can it be known? I think in writing those words in the mid-80s, he was reflecting the feeling, which was very strong then, that for many people, truth means what the scientists tell us. You can't believe the politicians. You can't be very sure about the religious people because religious truth is terribly subjective. If you want hard bedrock truth, you go to the scientist. Theodore Rozak, whom John mentioned earlier, is also someone who I have found very enlightening to read. And in his book, The Making of a Counterculture, which was published in 1969, he asks the question, what is reliable knowledge? Thank you, Colin. And this is the answer that he, as a historian and a culture and a sociologist, came up with. That for Western people, he said, reliable knowledge is knowledge that is scientifically sound, since science is that to which modern man refers for the definitive explication of reality. Forgive the American sociologies that's involved there. But I think he was right that in 1970, for the great majority of people, reliable knowledge was that which the scientists tell us. Now, I think that has been broken down a bit over the past 20 years, and the New Age movement has played its part in breaking that down. And I want now to very briefly survey the New Age critique of science. And if you want a very succinct example of this, turn to Fritjof Capra's book, The Turning Point, and Chapter 2. And I think he makes all these points that are on the next overhead in his critique of science. And New Agers are critical of modern science because they say it's materialistic, for a start. Scientists are only concerned with matter and energy, but matter and energy, as we shall see in a moment, are equivalent. But they're concerned with the material world, what can be weighed, measured, counted. Didn't Galileo make this great distinction? That was one of the great leap forwards in Western thought, that he limited investigation to that which could be measured, counted, quantified in various ways. And that means studying matter. And science has made us all very materialistic, and it denies, by ignoring, it denies spiritual reality. And so they blame science for the spiritual deadness of Western culture. Then they say science is deterministic, that the picture that the scientists have built for us from Newton onwards is that of a great cosmic machine. And the world we live in is a deterministic world. And out of that, for instance, comes behavioral psychology, which treats human beings simply as response mechanisms to the world, just as machines. and they object to this determinism because it's deadening to true humanness, they say. And they go on to critique science because they say it's reductionistic. Now, what do they mean by that? Well, the classic scientific approach to problems, the approach outlined certainly by Descartes, is to analyse things by taking them apart. You get a complex system that you can't understand. What do? Just give up and throw your hands up in horror and say it's too complicated? No, you take it apart and you look at the bits. And so you take human beings apart, and you don't try to study human beings, you study human cells. But the living cell itself is complex, so you take it apart and you study the components of the living cell, and you end up studying physics and chemistry, ultimately. And this reductionism, they say, has led to an ignoring of the whole organism and just the studying of the bits. And so in the end, people begin to think of human beings as simply, Bertrand Russell put it many years ago, collocations of atoms. And that's all we are, really, collocations of atoms, this reductionism, which they see inherent in science. Then they say science is objective. The aim of the scientist is to keep herself or himself out of the picture and to study nature objectively. And this, they say, has led to an alienation of human beings from nature. We see nature as something that we can dominate and exploit because it's inanimate, it's a machine, and it's different from us, and we stand over against it objectively and can use it for our own ends. And here is the root of our ecological problems. Then they say science is rationalistic. It is perhaps in our culture the paradigm of knowing, and it uses the combination of inductive and deductive rational logic. And so science is rationalistic, and it has led people to distrust and devalue the intuitive and particularly the subjective, the emotional side of human character. And so in knowing, we limit knowing to purely rational argument and what can be proved by empirical, inductive, and then deductive reasoning from the empirical. And we distrust the feminine intuitions, for instance. We distrust things that are emotional in us. We think that they cloud reason. And then finally, following from that, they say science has led us to dualistic thinking, led us to rely on the distinctions between either or. Go back to Kepler, who was mentioned earlier. The issue then was either the sun and the planets go round the earth, or the earth and the planets go round the sun. It's an either or. And time and again, science faces us with these distinctions. As a chemist, I know one of the major steps forward in chemistry was either when things burnt, they gave off phlogiston, or they absorbed oxygen. And which was it? And the advance of modern chemistry depended on that either-or decision. But, say the New Agers, life is not like that. Life is not based on either-or. It ought to be based on both and, that we hold together seemingly disparate truths, and therefore I can believe six impossible things before breakfast, as the White Queen said we should, because we remove the either-or distinctions. Now, if you really accept this critique of science, you will wonder whether science has any future in the New Age. And there are certainly those New Agers who believe it hasn't. Gary Zukav, who wrote the book The Dancing Wu Li Masters, says the last chapter of that book is entitled The End of Science. He declares we are approaching the end of science. He says this doesn't matter because it won't mean the end of the search for a more comprehensive an understanding of reality. What it does mean is that we'll pursue that search for comprehensive understanding of reality in a new way. And he quotes Professor Chu, a physics professor in the United States, who says that we are entering a completely new form of human intellectual endeavor, one that will not only lie outside physics, but will not even be describable as scientific. This will be the result of entering into the higher dimensions of human experience. What does he mean by that? Well, you'll obtain your truth by mystical experience, not by scientific investigation. Now, having said that, it is very surprising, perhaps, then to turn to people like Fridtjof Capra, Michael Talbot, even Gary Zukav himself and others, who seeming to be dismissive of science in this way and to say it has no future, then appeal to modern science to vindicate their view of nature, their view of the nature of truth and of reality. And Marilyn Ferguson, in her book The Aquarian Conspiracy, claims the new science goes beyond cool clinical observations to a realm of shimmering paradox where our very reason seems endangered. Now, what does she mean by the new science? Well, a lot of the critique I've given you will be labelled by New Agers as the critique of the Newtonian science, classical science. And what she is talking of is the new science, particularly of modern physics, of relativity. Now, we don't need that quite yet. Thank you. Relativity and quantum theory. And she is saying when we turn to that realm, we find it a realm of shimmering paradox which blows the mind and tells us the New Age approach to reality is right after all. Fridtjof Capra also says this. He says, the basic elements of the Eastern worldview are also those of the worldview emerging from modern physics. Eastern thought, and more generally mystical thought, provide a consistent and relevant background for the theories of contemporary science. Now, what are we to make of all this? I want to present to you now four statements from New Age thinking, which New Agers claim are supported by modern science, particularly modern physics. For those of you who are not scientists, don't immediately get alarmed. I will have to take you into some science. I'll try to do this simply as I can. If you don't follow the details, don't worry. It's the main line of the argument you need. What I'm going to do is present these four areas with the one example in each of the science that is claimed to support it, a brief critique from a scientific point of view of the New Age claim, and then when I've gone through the four areas, conclude with a general Christian response to what these people are saying about truth and science. So, yes, Colin, if we can have the first of those. Here is the first claim that New Agers make, that modern physics supports the view that the material world is an illusion and ultimate reality is an insubstantial flux of energy. The material world is an illusion and ultimate reality is an insubstantial flux of energy. Their support for this in what is probably one of the best known of all scientific equations, E equals mc squared. That equation which arises out of Einstein's theory of relativity, where E stands for energy, M for mass, and C is the speed of light. The equation states that mass and energy are interconvertible. And experiments in high-energy physics have verified this equation. It's now a well-established fact that not only can you create subatomic particles from energy, but you can transform one kind of particle into another by interaction of particles with energy. Now, Zukav and Capra make a great deal of this equivalence of matter and energy. Here's what Zukav says. In the East, he says, there's never been much philosophical or religious confusion about matter and energy. The world of matter is a relative world, an illusory one. Illusory not so much in the sense it doesn't exist, but in the sense we don't see it as it really is. The way it really is cannot be communicated verbally, but in an attempt to talk around it, Eastern literature speaks repeatedly of dancing energy and transient, impermanent forms. And this is strikingly similar to the picture of physical reality emerging from high-energy particle physics. Capra says, like modern physicists, Buddhists see all objects as processes in a universal flux and deny the existence of material substance. So they say, relativity theory, the interconversion of energy and matter, which is well proven in high-energy particle physics, supports this view that the world of matter is illusory and energy is ultimate reality. But they then also turn to the other area of physics, quantum theory, and I'm not going to go into that in any depth at this moment, but simply to say to you that modern quantum theory, one aspect of it is what's called quantum field theory, and this is a mathematical construct which expresses the reality of subatomic physics in terms of energy fields. And particles are seen as the result of interaction of energy fields. And Capra and Zhukov also pick up on this. Zhukov says, according to quantum field theory, fields alone are real. They are the substance of the universe, not matter. Matter is simply the momentary manifestation of interacting fields of energy, which are intangible and insubstantial. So this claim is made that both relativity and quantum theory support the view that matter is illusory. I want to say to you that this is total rubbish. It's unconvincing from a scientific point of view. Einstein's equation that E equals mc squared says nothing more or less than that matter can be converted into energy and vice versa. It's not saying that either matter or energy is more real. Is saying they can be interconverted. Quantum field theory simply says that both an energy field interpretation and a particle interpretation of reality at the subatomic level is open to you. It depends how you ask your question. If you ask your question in one way, the appropriate answer is expressed in the mathematics of energy fields. If you ask your question in another way, the appropriate answer comes out in the form of the mathematics of particles. Again, it's talking about an equivalence. And it's a sleight of hand when Capra and Zhukov and others say this shows that matter is illusory. It doesn't. For instance, if I said to you, and I think this is a fairly strict equivalence, if I said to you, ice is unreal because ice can be converted into water, and water's the ultimate reality, you'd say, I was talking nonsense, which I would be. And I feel that that's what they are doing, a sleight of hand trick here. In what the science says are two things that are equivalent, and they say one is illusory, the other is the ultimate reality. Now, we need to ask ourselves the question, which we will later, why do they insist on energy as the ultimate reality and matter is illusory? Well, let's move on to their second statement that they claim science supports, which is that the universe has to be seen as a unified, interconnected whole. The universe has to be seen as a unified, interconnected whole. Now, the key piece of evidence for this is another consequence of quantum theory, which is often called the Bell effect. Now, that's named after one of the physicists who studied it, though in fact this effect is something that Einstein and two of his co-workers, Podolsky and Rosen, first pointed out. Put very simply, and it's difficult to put it simply, but put very simply, the essence of the Bell effect is this. Many of you will know the law of conservation of momentum, which means that if you have a system that's got a certain amount of momentum, you can never destroy the momentum, you can only change it or apportion it differently. Well, according to quantum theory, if you've got a quantum system that comes into existence, and as I've said, you can produce particles out of interaction of energy fields, if you, say, get two particles that are formed at the same moment out of an energy interaction, they will have a certain combined momentum. It's a measure of energy or measure of velocity, depending on which you look at it, but they have combined momentum. Then these two particles fly apart, and maybe after quite a while, these particles are at opposite ends of the solar system, or indeed opposite ends of the galaxy. If you then change the momentum of one of the particles, instantaneously the momentum of the other will change to preserve the momentum, the combined momentum. Now, that may not seem very tremendous, but the mind-blowing thing about it for the physicist is that quantum theory says this change will happen instantaneously. You change one particle over here and you get instantaneous effect there, even if it's hundreds of millions of miles away. Now, the problem for the physicists with that is that according to the theory of relativity, any causal effect has to be transmitted in some form of energy or information or whatever, but can never be transmitted faster than the speed of light. And so if the particles are millions of miles away, it ought to take seconds or minutes for the effect to be produced by the cause. But the Bell effect is an effect that's instantaneous, however large the separation. What Bell did was to analyse the situation mathematically and produce a possible experimental test of this. And the experimental test was carried out very, very recently, just 2 or 3 years ago, and was found that the Bell effect does happen, that you do get this instantaneous effect in a quantum system. And Zhukov jumps on this and says, the Bell effect shows that what happens here is intimately and immediately connected to what happens elsewhere in the universe, which in turn is intimately and immediately connected to what happens elsewhere in the universe, and so on. Simply because the, in quotes, separate parts of the universe are not separate parts. That's what he's saying. The Bell effect shows us that certainly at the level of quantum events, the universe is not made up of separate parts. It's an interconnected whole. And what happens in one part instantaneously affects what happens in another. Now, again, I speak with some trepidation here because I have to say the mathematics of the Bell effect defeat me, but as I understand it, there is a fundamental confusion in what Zhukov and Capra and others do here in their appeal to the Bell effect, because the Bell effect can be interpreted in two ways. The most popular interpretation is the one I've given you, that it says there is an instantaneous action at a distance within a quantum system. However great the distance, the effect is instantaneous. The alternative interpretation is to say that there's no underlying physical reality corresponding to abstract concepts like electrons, position, momentum. That there's no underlying reality there, it's all just in my mind. Now, the thing here is that Capra wants to say it's all just in my mind. I'll give you a quote later in which he says this. He wants to say there's no underlying reality, it's just in my mind. But having done that, he can't legitimately appeal to the Bell effect to prove that everything's interconnected. You have to opt for one or other interpretation. And he tries to opt for both at once, having your cake and eating it. So there is an inconsistency there on the scientific level. Now, because of time, I'm going to ignore the holograms. Those of you who come to my workshop this afternoon, we'll talk about holograms if you want to. Let me move on to the third point. Thank you. Which is the claim that human consciousness plays a part in creating reality. That human consciousness plays a part in creating reality. We've seen how Shirley MacLaine claims this, that she is the creator. And the claim is that science supports this kind of statement. Now, here we do have to come back to quantum physics. Quantum physics has as its basis the realization that to explain certain phenomena in physics, one had to come to the conclusion that when you're dealing with small amounts of energy, a particle cannot have any amount of energy whatever. That energy only comes in fixed packets of fixed amounts. You know, you can't buy any quantity of sugar, you have to buy it in packets. And it only comes in certain economic community agreed sizes, and you take it or leave it. Well, that seems to be the situation when it comes to the energy, when it's energy in small amounts, that it has to come in fixed sized packets. And this has some amazing results when the implications of this were worked out. And one of the best known ones is Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. For those of you who like equations, I put the equation up there. If you don't like equations, ignore it. But what the principle says is that you cannot measure accurately at the same time both the position and the momentum of a particle. And there are other properties that are coupled by this principle. The best known are position and momentum. It says that the more accurately you know the position of a particle, the less you can know about its momentum. And the more accurately you know its momentum, the less you can know about its position. You cannot know both accurately at the same time. Now, that's one thing that follows from the quantization of energy. Another thing that follows from the quantization of energy is what's called the wave-particle duality. It was found that something like an electron, for instance, which when it was first discovered, seemed to behave like a particle, put it very crudely, a kind of minuscule snooker ball. Although that seemed to be the way it behaved in various experimental situations, there were other situations where it behaved like a wave when you throw a stone into a pond, the wave of water that spreads out. Certain of its properties were wave-like, certain of its properties were particle-like. And physicists have had to get used to the fact that an electron can behave in both modes. It never behaves in both modes at once, but in particular situations it behaves in one mode or the other. And this too follows from the quantization of energy. And quantum field theory can cope with this quite happily. But what's all the relevance of this for New Age thinkers like Capra and Zhukov and others? Well, they say, if there is a finite possibility, for instance, coming back to the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, if that's saying to us that you cannot be absolutely sure where an electron is, it ends up saying you have to say there's only a probability that an electron is in a particular place. It might be in point A, B, C, D, E, or F. It may have a 20% probability of being in A, 40% in B, 30% in F, and so on. Why does an electron appear at a particular point when I look at it? Why does it appear at point C when I look at it? Well, they say the very act of observing it fixes it where it is. And so by your decision to investigate, you create the nature of reality. By your decision to look at the electron, you fix where it is. That is what they claim. It's one possible interpretation. And then they say, if an electron can behave as either a wave or a particle, why does it behave as a wave when you look at it in a particular situation? Because you've decided to look at it in that situation. That your decision on the experimental setup you choose decides the nature of the reality you see, whether it's a wave or a particle. And so Capra will say, an electron does not have properties independent of my mind, that I decide what properties it has, whether it's a wave or a particle, whether it is at point A, B, or C. I create reality. And this leads to another physicist, Michael Talbot, to say, for centuries, the mystic has asserted that matter and consciousness are different aspects of the same something. For all those who spent their lives trying to penetrate the secrets of matter, the new physics has a message, not a new one, but one that may well turn out to be the most important rediscovery that humankind has ever made. The message of the new physics is that we are participators in a universe of increasing wonder, that we help to create it. Now, what do we say about this as scientists? Well, it's a very controverted area in the philosophy of science. Exactly what does quantum theory imply about reality and the relationship of human consciousness to reality? The interpretation which Capra and others put on it, that it means that our consciousness creates reality, is only one of several possible interpretations of the implications of quantum theory. I'm not going to take you through all the possibilities. But in particular, it can be argued that their view confuses the act of observation with the consciousness of the observer. And it is not my consciousness that affects reality. But the reality I see is in fact the result of interaction between my measuring instruments and what is measured. And we need to take that seriously. That the measuring instruments we use does affect what we see. But it's not saying that I create reality. But it does say my instruments influence how I see reality. And that's a different thing. It is not making this intimate connection that Capra and others want to make between my consciousness and reality. And just to give you one little sort of reductio ad absurdum, which follows from Capra's view, his view implies that if, for instance, I, as a particle physicist, decide to investigate subatomic particles through what's known as a cloud chamber, and the way you do that is you photograph the passage of particles through a chamber that's supersaturated with moisture, and you photograph it, and then later you develop and look at the photographs. Strictly speaking, Capra's view says you won't know what is on the photograph until someone actually looks at it, because then you create the reality. But if I take the photograph tonight and put it away in my drawer until tomorrow, what's on that photographic plate? Capra would have to say nothing until I look at it. And this is a problem that philosophers of science have been asking, not just in the last few years, but since these kind of issues began to be debated in the 1930s and 40s. Now, even if one does opt for the possibility that the consciousness of the observer is affecting the result of the measurement, I said one way is to say, no, there is a break here. It's the instruments that are important, not my consciousness. But even if one does accept Capra's approach and say my consciousness affects what is seen, again, one doesn't have to say this means I create reality. It may mean only that there are a number of different aspects to reality, and by looking at it, I select just one of those aspects. I see just one of those aspects. Again, it doesn't lead me to say that the reality isn't there until I look at it or that I create it. It simply says I only notice one aspect of it, and my conscious decision affects which aspect I see, and that is all. Well, fourthly and finally in this section, fourth statement New Agers want to make, and this brings us really down back hard to the question of truth, is that to understand reality, they say, we have to abandon classical logic. We have to replace the logic of either or by the logic of both and. And as a result, they say, you can only know truth by experience. You have to experience it, because your mind can't get around combining the both and the and. And you can only experience what it means to know truth in this holistic both and way. Well, logic is the discipline which attempts to distinguish bad reasoning from good reasoning. I think that's the best way one can define the discipline of logic. It attempts to formulate rules which tell us whether the reasons given for a particular conclusion are good reasons or not. And these rules form a logical system. And the essential requirement of any logical system is that it's self-consistent. The rules, or they're sometimes called the laws of logic in any particular system, are so framed that if they're applied properly, then you can't use them to prove statements that are mutually contradictory within the framework of the system. If within my system of logic I can prove two, let alone six, impossible contradictory things before breakfast, there's something wrong with my logical system. So it's usually been held. The logic which we use in everyday discussion and debate is what's called classical logic. It makes use of rules that have been discussed and formulated, well, at least since the time of Aristotle. But in the 1930s, as quantum physics began to develop, people began to investigate the logic of quantum systems. And this is a highly mathematical investigation. And a very important paper was written in 1936 by von Neumann and Birkhoff, in which they laid the basis for quantum logic, as it's come to be called. And the most important difference that they highlighted between quantum logic and classical logic involves the law of distributivity, which I've put up there on the overhead for you. This law says that there are two statements that are equivalent in meaning. One is the statement that A, comma, and B or C, that statement A, comma, and B or C, means the same as the statement A and B, comma, or A and C. Now let me give you an example, which is the next overhead, which I hope will clarify this. If I say, I toss a coin and it comes up heads or it comes up tails, that's a statement of the form A, comma, B, and C. I toss a coin is A, and it comes up heads is B, or it comes up tails is C. So there's your elements, A, B, and C. But I can say exactly the same thing in a longer way by saying, I toss a coin and it comes up heads, or I can toss a coin and it comes up tails. That's putting it in the A and B, A and C way. Yes, I put a B there when I should have put a C. Sorry, the bottom there should have a C, not a B. So that's a basic law in our common logic, and it prevents us using the both and arguments in logic. It leads us to the either or arguments. I haven't the time to show you how that follows, but it does. Now, because that law does not apply in quantum logic, it is possible to get a situation where you can talk about an electron being both a particle and a wave, or at least having both particle and wave properties. These seemingly incompatible properties of wave behavior and particle behavior can be attributed to an electron because the law of distributivity breaks down in quantum logic. Now, that leads people, such as, for example, David Finkelstein, an eminent physicist in the States, to say this shows us that we shouldn't hold on to the either-or distinction, but that we should embrace the both-and distinction. He says in quantum physics we've come to learn that there aren't either waves or particles running around. There is something else, which is both-and. We can't define what it is, but it is both-and. And he says quantum logic is more real than classical logic because classical logic is a set of theoretical rules that we've devised to constrain our thinking. Quantum logic is based on experience, the experience of the physicist in the laboratory. That's empirical experience we're dealing with there, and it has taught us that we have to accept both and logic. And this is more real, therefore, than the either-or logic of classical thinking. Now, he's making three claims here. He is saying classical logic is a theoretical system of rules that constrains human thought in an artificial way, that quantum logic is preferable because it arises from experience, the experience of the ultimate reality, the energy fields of quantum physics, and thirdly, it leads him to say that subjective experience is the ultimate form of knowledge. Because, he says, how can you really explain quantum physics to someone you can't, because it's beyond communication in rational thought, you just have to help them experience it. You tell them how they can go into the laboratory and following certain patterns of behavior can experience quantum physics, and then they will have touched base with reality. Now, it seems to me that the contrast here made between classical and quantum logic is largely invalid. Classical logic is not a purely theoretical system invented by scholars living in ivory towers who are unconcerned about any correspondence between their logical arguments and ordinary people's experience of life. There is that anti-intellectualism abroad, not only in the church, but in our society, which likes to consider all scholars are of that nature, living in ivory towers, detached from reality. But logicians weren't and aren't. Classical logic grew up because of the scholars wishing to derive and to decide what kinds of reasoning make good sense of our experience of the world. That's what they were concerned with. How do we make good sense of what we experience in day-to-day reality? And one has to say the laws of classical logic have been a great success in this regard. Up until quantum logic came along, the whole of science was founded on classical logic alone and had tremendous success in making good sense of the world in which we live. True, the problem that now faces us is that this logic, which makes good sense of the macro world, doesn't seem to make sense of the micro world, the world of atoms and subatomic particles. And that does raise the question of the relative status of classical logic and quantum logic. Does quantum logic now show us that we've been wrong all along? Well, again, it's a very difficult question, and it's a very new question, and the philosophers of science are still hotly debating it. It seems to me that there are two opinions about it. And if you want to look at this, one of the more understandable books on this is written by someone called Gibbons. It's called Particles and Paradoxes. But it seems to me that it is the view of a small minority of philosophers of science and logic who conclude that the real logic is quantum logic, and that's meant to be the real logic both of the macro world and of the micro world. That faces a problem. It does face the problem of the tremendous success of classical logic, at least since Aristotle onwards, and I mean before Aristotle, people were using classical logic, they just didn't know they were using it. But it's been a tremendous success, and therefore it does really seem to be rather precipitate to say that now we must overthrow it and reject it. And so the great majority of philosophers have, at the moment, hold the view that there are two different logics which are appropriate in their own domain. The micro world requires quantum logic, the macro world requires classical logic. And I think we shouldn't forget here that when they say this, when they say that the micro world requires quantum logic, they're saying that because of a particular mathematical construct that is used to enable physicists to model the micro world. Now, who knows, in 20 years' time, a new mathematical construct may be needed. And you may find it's a construct that resolves this paradox between the law of distributivity operating at one level and not another. At the moment, we cannot resolve it. We just have to say that there are two logics and we can't see how they hang together. It doesn't mean we'll never see how they hang together. But then, if we for the moment accept they don't hang together, we have to say which world, if you like, is the real world, the quantum world, or the world of everyday experience. New Agers claim that it's the micro world. It's the world of quantum physics that's the real world, and therefore that's the logic we should accept. Now, for me, the amazing thing is that in saying this, they are being thoroughly reductionistic. Whereas, in fact, at every other level, they say to us, we mustn't be reductionist. That's nasty. That's a bad way to behave. But when they say it's the world of quantum field theory that's the real world, on which we must base our logic and interpret our experience, they are saying it's the world of the bits that's the real world. When you take everything apart, you ultimately come to subatomic particles. And that is reality. And if that requires quantum logic, that's the real logic. And we want the logic of both and not the logic of either or. Why shouldn't we turn the tables and take our experience of the micro world as the touchstone of reality and say, look, you're always telling us to be holistic. Let's be holistic. And let's recognize that on the basis of holism, that we must take the macro world as the world of ultimate reality. And I think that that is a way that's open to us to do, and we'll come back to how we justify these kinds of decisions. But if we do that, we're then saying that it is the world of human consciousness, the macro world which involves human consciousness, that is the world of ultimate reality for us, and that classical logic is the logic that is the logic we are to live by. And somehow in time we will find a way of interrelating these two types of logic. We just haven't got there yet, which is not surprising after only, 30 or 40 years of really studying quantum logic. Well, so much for the science. That's left some of you a bit bemused. We'll turn to the much easier subject of theology now. And a brief Christian response to some of the things that I have been putting before you. As a Christian, I find myself in agreement with many of the negative things that New Agers are saying about science. Just as John Stott has rightly said to us, many of the things they're saying challenge us in terms of re-examining the church and our Christian commitment. I think a lot of the things the New Agers are saying challenge me as someone who still considers myself a scientist, although I may have metamorphosized into a bit of a theologian. It challenges me in my view of science. But I would want to say that what they are criticizing is not really science, but what John called pseudoscience, what I would call perhaps scientism. What they are criticizing is a metaphysical belief system which takes as one of its basic assumptions the belief that the scientific method is the only valid route to truth, and that scientific truth is the truth with a capital T. Now, they are criticizing that metaphysical belief system, which is not necessary to accept if you're going to be a scientist. That is a religion of its own, which I would label scientism. And if you reject that belief in scientism, you can still go on doing perfectly good science. You are simply saying truth is not limited to what the scientists can tell us. The scientific method is not the only way of investigating reality. And in particular, when it comes to reductionism, I would say as a scientist, yes, of course, in my method, I was a reductionist in the scientific laboratory. I worked with digestive enzymes, and that was taking apart our digestive system, metaphorically speaking, I assure you, and investigating some of the macromolecules that are at work in it. That was reductionist in methodology. But as a Christian, I am not a reductionist. I do not say that human beings are nothing but a collection of atoms and molecules. Indeed, I think there's good scientific reasons for saying this. Over the last 20 years or so, philosophers of science have come to recognize that scientific theories operate at different levels of physical complexity, and that you can't simply derive a theory at one level by taking the system apart and looking at the bits. A classical example here is the genetic code. The genetic code is a construct which scientists have produced to help us understand how the gene system works in a cell, in controlling the behavior of the cell. But if you take the genes, which are macromolecules, and you take them apart into nucleic acids, there's nothing about the physics and chemistry of nucleic acids that would lead you to predict the existence of the genetic code. You're working at two levels here. At the level of physics and chemistry, genetic code means nothing. You couldn't predict it. You can't derive it from the physics and chemistry. But when you put the system together into a macromolecule, at that level of complexity, you have to talk about something radically new, a genetic code. And the two, one cannot be derived from the other. And so there's scientists are beginning to recognize that reductionism has its limits even within science. And so much more, I would say, in reality and in our experience, that the whole is more than the sum of the parts. And as Christians, we want to say that the human person cannot be specified totally and completely in terms of physics and chemistry. There is a human spirit made in the image of its creator, which is expressed through the material body, but can't be identified with the material body. Now, how the two are related is a big issue that, again, the philosophers have debated, the body-mind relationship, the spirit-body relationship, whatever you want to say. And is the matter that we need to go on discussing. My own way of thinking about it, and I throw this out as I hope may be helpful to you, is rather in terms of the meaning of something like I've got in front of me, which, from the scientific point of view, that's a pattern of carbon on cellulose. And cellulose is the paper, and there's a pattern of carbon dots on it. Now, by studying the carbon dots as a scientist, I could specify the position of every little particle of carbon on this sheet, but that would not tell you anything about what it means in terms of what I'm saying to you now. And for me, to talk about the human spirit, human spiritual experience, and so on, in relation to the physics and chemistry, which I studied as a chemist and biochemist, is that kind of distinction. There is a meaning that's only there when you put the whole thing together, and which cannot be discovered by taking it apart. You look at the bits, you'll not discover the meaning. You'll discover the hardware through which the meaning is expressed. Now, it seems to me Scripture says those two things are very intimately related, such that the Christian hope is not for a disembodied spirit or disembodied soul, but for a resurrected body. Yes, a transformed, glorified body, but a body which still is used to express the human spirit in its new form, as God will recreate it. Now, so much for their sort of general comment about their critique of science and what I would agree with it in it. Let's go a bit further to some of the things that they claim support their worldview. This, for instance, this interrelated oneness of all things. I accept that the Bell effect is a genuine effect. It's experimentally proven, so it seems to me. And it does tell me there is an interrelated, interconnected oneness about all things at the quantum level. Now, this doesn't surprise me as a Christian. It doesn't cause me any problems as a Christian. Because if the universe is the creation of the one and only Creator who keeps it in being, well, then one might expect that there will be a fundamental coherence and unity about that creation. And if, as Christians believe, the Creator is a being whose actions are characterized by rationality and reliability, I would expect us to find this kind of interrelated oneness that can be expressed in the mathematical equations of quantum field theory. It doesn't surprise me or worry me at all. And indeed, moreover, the Christian concept of God as a Trinitarian God, a God who is a harmonious interrelationship of persons, seems to me to be quite compatible with seeing the universe as an interconnected, harmonious oneness, although at an impersonal level in the case of quantum physics. Is this the creation reflecting the glory of God? I think it might well be. It's another reflection of the glory of God, of the triune, harmonious relationship of God at the subatomic level. Now, it seems to me that when Capra says that this interconnectedness of all things the assertion that they're making that because of this interconnectedness of all things, the separate parts into which our analytical thinking divides the universe is unreal, does not follow from the physics I've already said. Capra postulates the unreality of the parts, material parts as we experience them, purely on the basis of his monist metaphysics. That's the only thing that justifies his decision. He wants a monist metaphysic that says the parts are unreal, and so he interprets E equals MC squared in the way he wants to. But it's not a scientifically derived or valid interpretation. On the basis of a Trinitarian metaphysic, I can say, I can see the possibility of the harmonious unity which preserves diversity and doesn't dissolve it into undifferentiated oneness. That in God we see eternal individual identity of Father, Son, and Spirit, and yet a harmonious unity, which means we speak of one God. And with that metaphysic, I have no problems with holding together the quantum world and the world of diversity that I see around me. And this brings me back to the question about classical logic and quantum logic. Again, why does Capra go for the world of undifferentiated quantized energy fields as the ultimate reality and then say it's the logic of that world we must live by? Well, he tells us why. Not in the body of his book, The Tao of Physics, but in the preface. I wonder how many people bother to read prefaces. In the preface, he says he one day had a beautiful experience when he was sitting on the beach, watching the light dancing on the waves. He said that at that time he felt the atoms of his body participating in the cosmic dance of energy. It's on this basis, and that basis alone, that he makes the jump from physics to metaphysics. And I don't know whether you spotted it, but through all that I've been saying about the New Age appeal to modern science, modern physics, they have made an assumption that you can identify physical energy, which is what quantum field theory and relativity is talking about, you can identify physical energy with mystical or psychic or spiritual energy, whatever you want to call it. That when they are talking in terms of Buddhism and Hinduism, those mystics are talking about what they would call spiritual energy. Is that the same as the energy that quantum field theory talks about? Capra assumes it is, and I think we at least ought to ask him to prove it or to give some kind of rational basis for making that equation. And I think that the Christian has as much right as Capra to choose to understand science within our own metaphysical or theological framework. And for me, that is the framework of belief in an infinite, self-existent, personal God who created the ordered universe and sustains it in being, And therefore the universe does have an objective reality apart from my looking at it, because it's created by God and he sustains it whether I'm looking at it or not. And as human beings, we're created in the image of God, and therefore our minds, which are pale reflections, finite reflections of his mind, can expect to understand that out there objective universe that he's keeping in being. And although our understanding of reality will be limited because of our finiteness, although it will be distorted because it's coloured by our fallenness, that doesn't make the search for objective reality and objective knowledge pointless. It just means we have to accept that at any one time our knowledge is only provisional, only approximate. But as human beings who are rational, sharing in God's image, and experiencing this same created objective reality, it's reasonable for me to be able to expect to communicate my experience of the world with my fellow human beings and to be able to have rational communication with them, even if it's not exhaustive communication. Of course, Capra and others are right that we must not deny or devalue intuition, emotion, and so on. They're part of our human experience. But we still can communicate rationally and communicate truth in doing so. And moreover, as I've said, if God we believe in is a Trinitarian God, then as Christians we are able and ready to accept the differences manifested in the macro world and see them as real differences and not dissolve them into an illusion. Now finally, it seems to me there are two significant differences between the appeal to this Christian theistic framework with regard to science and knowledge and the appeal to the New Age's monistic metaphysics. The first is that the Christian framework is open to at least a degree of public verification, because at the heart of it are the historical events of the birth, life, teaching, death, and resurrection of Jesus. And if a New Ager wants to say to us, well, where do you get your metaphysic from? I say, I get it from Jesus. And we can discuss Jesus as a historic human person, and we can discuss his teaching and the reliability of the record of his teaching and so on. The New Ager cannot do that with their metaphysic. It's not grounded in anything objectively discussable or verifiable. It's based on an incommunicable subjective experience. The second thing is that modern science grew up in, and to a considerable degree was based upon, the Christian framework. I can't justify that statement now, but I can give you a long list of historians and philosophers of science, some of them not Christians, who would accept that. That modern science, as one philosopher has put it, is the legitimate child of a great religious movement, and its genealogy goes back to Jesus. Which is why I think Christians who decry science are doing something very dangerous. But having said that, modern science grew up on, and to a considerable degree is based on, a Christian framework. The New Age framework, which Capra wants to put upon it, as Zukav says, will ultimately bring about the end of science.